It's Philosophy Talk.
This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now.
Who has a right to decide my own medical treatment other than me? I don't need no doctor,
'cause I know what's in it. The point is, Turk, if someone tried to pull the plug on you without being totally honest with me, you know where they'd end up?
In hell watching The View.
Next to the super high unreachable cupcake table.
I don't need no doctor, no, no, 'cause I know what's in it.
Is consent always necessary before treating a patient?
There's a whole list of people who don't get to make their own medical decisions. The severely depressed, the mentally ill, children.
I've been too long away from a baby. Oh, I'm coming down with a misery.
The limits of medical consent.
Our guest is Jody Halpern from the UC Berkeley School of Public Health.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Never permissible to force medical treatment on a patient against their will.
What if they're so emotionally distraught that they can't even think straight?
What if they might die without the treatment?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm Laura McGuire, sitting in for John Perry, who's taking a well-deserved break.
And we're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ken teaches philosophy, and I'm director of research for Philosophy Talk.
So, Laura, how do you like stepping out of the shadows and into the broadcast booth after all these years?
Oh, Ken, it's not even remotely terrifying. Oh. Thank you for asking.
I know you're going to do. You're going to do just fine. Now, today, we're thinking about the limits of medical consent.
There are some people who are not fully competent to make their own medical decisions, but where exactly do we draw the line between the competent and the incompetent?
Well, at one extreme, we've got children. I mean, I have no problem with if a skittish 9-year-old refuses to let the doctor give her a much-needed shot. I see nothing wrong with making the kid take the shot. I'd be gentle about it, but make the kid take the shot.
Well, there's also some adults who are just cognitively impaired. For example, a person in a coma can neither grant nor withhold consent, but we don't deny them care because of that.
Yeah, that would be really strange to do. Now, immaturity and incapacity, like being in a coma, they'll seem like the easy cases, Laura. But here's the harder question. Is it ever okay to compel a mature adult who is not incapacitated to undergo a medical procedure against that person's will?
No, if they're not incapacitated, Ken, we can't coerce them. We need to respect the patient's autonomy.
Oh, that's easy to say, but look, suppose you've got a patient with, I don't know, very poor impulse control and very little foresight, very little capacity to reason logically.
So you're thinking of a grown-up who has the maturity level of a 6-year-old, something like that?
Yes, that's exactly what I'm thinking of. This patient keeps promising to change their habits. They keep promising to make better choices. They say, I'll come in for that treatment. I will. But each time they fail, and they fail over and over and over again. What are you going to do as that person's physician?
Well, you know what, Ken? Here's the reality. At some point, grown-ups have to live with the consequences of their choices. That's the burden of being an autonomous being.
Yeah, it's easy to say. But look, this patient isn't really a fully functioning adult. And by leaving the decision entirely up to them, aren't we helping to make things worse for them? Aren't we doing some harm to this kind of patient? And, you know, physicians are supposed to do no harm, but you're doing harm.
Well, you'd be doing them a much greater harm if you simply took away their right to decide. That would be infantilizing them. You'd be denying them their basic human autonomy, Ken.
Okay, I know. Okay, you love autonomy. I love autonomy, too, but let me give you a case of a different kind. Suppose a man loses his wife in a terrible accident, and he's injured too, very grievously injured in this accident. He's so grief-stricken that he can't imagine going on. He's so distraught he refuses urgently needed medical treatment that would help keep him alive. Now, do you force the treatment on him against his will, or do you just let him die?
Ken, that's very black and white. I don't see why there's an either-or here. I mean, the obvious thing to do would be give him some time to get over his grief, and then let him decide for himself what he wants to do.
You're trying to take the easy way out. I'm going to just stipulate. You can't wait. Okay? If you wait, he dies. It's my example. If he waits, you die.
Okay, we'll stick with your example. I don't know what in this case. I mean, I would hope he would eventually get over his grief, but in the meantime, I suppose I would do whatever I can just to keep him alive.
Okay, so tell me why this case is different from the first in which you had this childlike adult. Why is it different from the first?
Well, because letting a person die because they're grief-stricken is much worse than letting some overgrown juvenile continue to live in an unhealthy or irresponsible way, whatever that is.
Well, wait a minute. What if the grief-stricken person, patient, doesn't see it this way, Laura? Suppose he comes back in a year. He's fully physically recovered, but he's still in the throes of profound grief. What are you going to do then?
Well, if I was this patient's doctor, I suppose I would ask him, is he seeing a therapist? Is he getting benefit from that therapy? If he's not, then I might recommend a good grief counselor to him.
You're still looking for the easy way out. I'm still not going to let you off the hook. He doesn't want any more counseling. He refuses all counseling. What he wants is to end his life. And he thinks you owe him because you made him live last year. And he asks you as his doctor, help me.
So you want me to help him commit suicide?
Yes, that's the question. Would you do it? Should you do it?
Wow, that's a very difficult question. I mean, it would be one thing if he was terminally ill, but if he's physically healthy and he asks me to end his life, I don't think I would or that I should help him die in that situation. What he really needs is better psychological support.
But let's go back to autonomy, Laura. Can we really force someone to live against their will? Why is that any more acceptable than forcing them to undergo medical care against their will?
You know what? I'm not even going to answer that question, Ken. Instead, I'm going to leave it to our roving philosophical reporter, Liza Veal. We sent her out to examine some real-life cases from the perspective of a California doctor who regularly deals with just this kind of dilemma, up close and personal. She files this report.
Here's an email that I got yesterday saying, I have been battling with a mental illness. I fear becoming insane. This burden is too much to bear, and I want to end my life. Could you help me with this decision?
Dr. Lonnie Shavelson gets a lot of emails like this.
Another patient says, I would like to learn more about assisted suicide or how to obtain the drugs I need for a peaceful death that would not traumatize my two adult children. I'm hoping you can help me with a quiet and dignified end.
They're typically writing for the same reason.
I get a significant number of requests from people who have emotional illnesses who are asking me to help them in a suicide. What I do and what my medical practice is physician aid in dying for terminally ill patients.
People with a prognosis of 6 months or less. This has been legal in California since 2016, but the law doesn't apply to the people emailing Dr. Shavelson.
It has no provision for people who are not terminally ill, but suffering severely emotionally. There just is no provision for that.
Consent is a big part of why. The idea is that a suicidal person is mentally compromised and therefore doesn't have the capacity to consent to the procedure. But in their emails to Dr. Shavelson, many people insist that their desire to end their life is rational. They say things like,
you know, I've been depressed all of my life. I've been miserable all of my life. I have been to Stanford, UCSF, various physicians. I've taken all the medications and all that. I just can't go on anymore. And I may fully agree that that person, they're ready to die.
And they feel they have the same right as terminally ill people to die with dignity. But they need a doctor's help.
A nonviolent suicide is hard because not all medicines work. There's a lot of mythology out there of, oh, I could just take, you know, 10 pills of the following and I'll die, and often it doesn't work, and you wind up coming out more damaged than you started.
Wanting to eliminate those risks and spare your family members from witnessing that violence may be totally rational, but the patient's wishes and capacity to consent isn't the whole equation. There's also the consent of the physician. Patients can't just demand any treatment they want.
So, for example, you come in and you tell me that I have an itchy right elbow, and you say you would like antibiotics for that. And you can say that it's your autonomous decision to want antibiotics for that, and I still have a professional responsibility to say we don't use antibiotics for itchy right elbows.
In other words, it's up to the doctor to decide what's right for you. And when it comes to assisted suicide for emotionally suffering people, Dr. Shavelson says he can't make those judgment calls about who really will never get better.
There's a point both as a human being and a physician where I have to make a decision to ignore my own wishes.
His wish as a doctor to help his patients and give them what they're asking for.
That's not only because the law says I can't. It's an admission of my own fallibility.
The human fallibility in each of us, even doctors. That's why even if it were legal, Dr. Shavelson says he'd never consent to participate. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Liza Veal.
Thanks for that really powerful report, Liza. I'm Ken Taylor. With me is Philosophy Talk's Director of Research, Laura McGuire. And today we're asking about the limits of medical consent.
We're joined now by Jody Halpern. She's a professor of bioethics at the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. She's author of From Detached Concern to Empathy, Humanizing Medical Practice. Jody, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So, Jody, these are clearly some very thorny issues we're going to get into today. And what got you wanting to spend so much of your time thinking about these thorny issues?
Early in my training as a physician, I've always been very interested in empathy and communication. And a particular situation really disturbed me. A woman in her early 50s came to the hospital for a second above-the-knee amputation related to diabetes. And she knew she'd use a wheelchair afterward, and she had gone through an adjustment process, getting used to that idea, had adapted her home. By the time she came in, she was in good spirits. And after the surgery, she was also in good spirits with, you know, some mild post-op pain that was, I mean, it was being treated. And she was looking forward to returning to her career as an artist and to her life. And then about 2 days after the surgery, her husband of many years told her he was leaving her. And suddenly her post-operative pain increased, and she said she no longer wanted to live. She didn't want to have dialysis. And she rejected a group of very devoted women friends and kept them out of her room. She told the bioethicist that she understood that she'd die without dialysis, but that she no longer wanted to adapt to her life at changes. And he then met with the medical team, and they decided quickly that she understood the risks and benefits of treatment, met the criteria for decisional competence, and that they actually thought that it made sense that she didn't want to go on with her life to them. And they basically gave her the morphine that she requested to treat her postoperative pain. She slept on and off and passed away a few days later.
Wow.
That's a really difficult case. So the doctors in this case decided that she did have the capacity, but I know you think that even though she was fully competent cognitively on a certain level, that she temporarily lost her decision-making capacity. So can you say a little bit more about what is it that she lost temporarily?
She was in a situation that we're all vulnerable to when we have terrible acute grief or loss or shame, which is her sense of even having a future was shut down. Her ability to imagine going on had been radically shut down emotionally, which happens to us during traumatic emotional events. And the team's process of communication with her never addressed that.
But, I mean, emotional events overcome us a lot. Does the law recognize? I mean, under the law, did the physicians do the right thing?
Yes.
Well, gee, that means the law, you must think the law is inadequate then.
Yes. But it's not so much even legal changes as cultural changes I'd like to see in how physicians practice the interactive process that it should be of informed consent and of really empathically, curiously understanding what's going on with patients.
Suppose I make a decision when I'm really upbeat, really, really super upbeat. You know, I'm not, I don't think, bipolar in any way, but I do have my really upbeat days, you know, and then I have my down days and I have my in-between days. Can upbeat thinking and feeling distort decisions in the same way that downbeat thinking and feeling can?
Absolutely. I had a patient who was hypomanic or very, very upbeat, who had a cardiac arrhythmia that went down all the way where she could have died. And she needed a pacemaker, and she was making the decision about it. And she understood the treatment, and she understood why the doctors thought she needed it. But she said, I just feel so good. It doesn't seem like this could really be the case. I know what you're saying, but it just feels like I feel too good for this to be true.
So, Jody, in this case of the diabetic woman, you think she temporarily lost her capacity to make a decision, but you're not advocating that the doctors should have overridden her decision, or what would you have prescribed looking back now?
I think that what I saw, and I write about it in my book, is that the doctors were too precipitously influenced by her emotional states themselves. They felt hopeless and helpless about communicating with her. I think they could have been given more time and attention without turning up the morphine to communicating better.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about the limits of medical consent.
In our next segment, we'll ask just what the capacity for informed consent really amounts to. What factors must be present to make consent count as fully informed? And does the temporary absence of those factors give us the right to override the decisions and choices of the patient?
Putting consent and coercion in context when Philosophy Talk continues. Would you sign that waiver if that was your surgeon? I'm not sure about me. When can someone refuse to give their consent for medical treatment? And who, if anyone, can ever override that refusal? I'm Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Laura McGuire, sitting in for John Perry, and we're thinking about the limits of medical consent. Our guest is Jody Halpern from the UC Berkeley School of Public Health, author of From Detached Concern to Empathy, Humanizing Medical Practice.
So, Jody, I assume that both legally and morally speaking, no doctor really has the power to make choices for a patient not based on her full and informed consent. But what exactly does this full and informed consent and the capacity for full and informed consent consist of? I don't think I've ever seen that notion spelled out in gory detail. So can you give us a little primer on that?
Yes, an early mentor of mine, Jay Katz, put it well, that it's an interaction, a communication, so that just as the patient needs to get from the doctor or researcher the medical facts, the doctor needs to understand the values and subjective needs, fears, and concerns of the patient so that together they can figure out what is best according to the patient's values. And that's the part that's missing, I think, in our current system, is a training and attention and time to understand what the patient is most concerned about, why they're refusing treatment or why they're wanting treatment. And so we see this in both research settings and other settings that this isn't adequately understood. And there's too much focus on the narrow medical procedure and conveying that, which is what the doctors think about, and not enough understanding of what the patient thinks their quality of life will be going home after the procedure.
So I want to follow up on something you mentioned in passing, because I've read a little bit about this, and I gather this inclusion, you mentioned values, the patient's values, and I gather that that's a little bit, I don't know, controversial, I don't know if that's the right word, but when you look at it, some people list values as an important thing and some people don't, and as a philosopher, that word screams to us. Values are not just what I desire right now.
Right.
Right. Values are something, it's hard to say exactly what valuing is, but it's something like a considered judgment, right? And all things considered, what matters to me?
Right.
I mean, I may feel like I want to kill you right now because I'm overwhelmed with anger and rage or something, but that's contrary to my values, right? So I don't do it, right? Because somehow my values take over. So in the medical context, I mean, value, you know, decide what I value calls for a kind of reflection, not just a kind of reaction.
Exactly. So that's why emotionally reactive states during trauma can really get in the way of you even having an ability to deliberate about your values, and that's why you need support. Autonomy, Kant thought autonomy was self-standing, like that's a German word for a lamp standing by itself in a room. He thought we were radically independent.
Right.
But Jay Katz and others have shown that our ability to exercise our autonomy or act on what we most care about or value is socially interdependent, especially because we're vulnerable during loss. We need someone to help us hold our world open and think about what's really important to us.
So let me ask you about that. So does either the law or medical practice have a deep interrogation of this notion of autonomy? I ask this because we've done a show autonomy and the law because of animal rights and stuff like that. It turns out the law has a really shallow understanding of autonomy. Hence, it thinks a corporation can be a person. It thinks in New Zealand, under common law, a river can be a person because a river is autonomous. It's like really shallow and silly. It would like embarrass any philosophy student to write this stuff. So does the medical practice have a deep interrogation of what autonomy comes to or not?
Not in its legal or bureaucratic systematic practice. I think some psychiatrists, psychotherapists, primary care doctors, they're people that actually in practice have those sort of relationships that are autonomy supporting. But the written rules, the one place that I've been working on with others, there's this notion of an informed consent that the patient should appreciate, not just understand the medical facts. People only focus on the medical facts too much in practice, but there's this word appreciation, that the patient should appreciate how it applies to his or her life. So that gives some room. It's usually not implemented with enough depth to look at these issues of what's really important to people, but it's at least an area that we can work on.
So in this case that you talk about, the diabetic woman, is she not autonomous? I'm trying to understand exactly what the problem in this situation is. Where is she lacking a capacity, and what specific capacity is that?
So again, I think she has full cognitive capacity. I think she's temporarily blocked from exercising it for emotional reasons, and now I'll say how. But again, legally, I would not override her wishes based on, for lots of reasons. I think we had a moral obligation to provide more support for her. But the blockage, just as a philosopher, what's interesting to me is that fundamentally, autonomy requires the capacity to deliberate, and that requires being able to weigh and balance options and see things in more than one way. And I talk about people like her being subject to what I call them concretized emotional states, but catastrophic thinking or wishful thinking, when you're in an emotionally overly fixed state. Emotions involve beliefs. This is very important. This philosophy has a lot to teach medicine. Emotions are
I'm
ways.
I'm glad you said that.
It's true. That's most of my work, is that having a fixed, I don't think doctors and the legal system understand that emotions have cognitive content, and that certain kinds of emotionally traumatic states involve fixed cognitive content that can undermine your ability to see things more than one way. So a standard I would like, not to override people but to help them, is if a patient is in a very strong emotional state like Ms. G was, and they realize that they're very distressed, but they don't realize that that's blocking their ability to deliberate, that's a big problem. All I want is a minimal capacity to deliberate, is someone to recognize that they're subject to a strong emotional view. If I'm very angry at someone and I realize that I see everything they do is terrible, but at least I know I'm angry at them, I'm open to the idea that someone else might see something another way, that minimal cognitive capacity to see that things could be otherwise is what I see philosophically as the minimal capacity for autonomy.
So being able to deliberate is clearly important for you, but I'm wondering, in a different case, someone who is not undergoing this trauma like Miss G was, but is just not a very rational thinker. So they take some steps that might look like a deliberative process, but really there's like jumps of logic. They don't really follow evidence. They're just not very good reasoners. Do they lack autonomy?
Again, I want to make it clear, I'm not talking about overriding people's rights. That's very important. But yes, I think that to exercise your capacity of autonomy, you need to be able to have, as Ken was saying, your values, your core and fundamental, more important things need to play a very important role. And so when you're having difficulty doing that because of inattentiveness or other cognitive blocks, what we owe those people assistance so that they can exercise their capacity and express their more fundamental values.
Gabrielle from San Francisco called in. She didn't want to speak on the air, Jody, but she argued with our call screener that the following. I wonder if you categorically agree or disagree or not with this thing that Gabrielle said. Doctors do not have the right to continue to take care of patients who don't want to be taken care of, period. Do you think that's true?
It sounds too general for me to understand. I'd have to know I would love to have talked to her and heard the case she has in mind.
So amend that for Gabrielle in a way that's acceptable to you?
Well, she said taking care of. I mean, the thing that I think Gabrielle's probably picking up on is that we live in a society that tremendously neglects. We neglect each other. We're not. We don't have a lot of solidarity and social connection in our society. So until you're in the hospital, you might lack all sorts of assistance that you need. Suddenly, when you're in the hospital, doctors think they can rule your life, and I agree that that's ridiculous. On the other hand, I think that people do need people to be concerned about them, and in certain states of mine in people's lives, they sometimes need people to at least interfere enough to check up on them and try to offer them help.
So, this goes back to something that I asked Laura in the opening, and she dismissed it, and I was right to dismiss it. But because you get this person who's a bad decision maker, who are making decisions that we can see are not consonant with her best good, right? She doesn't. I don't know, maybe she doesn't fully appreciate, or she does appreciate, but she's weakness of the will, she can't make herself do what she knows she ought to do and stuff like that, but she's kind of got a little bit of self-deception going on there. She thinks she's going to start exercising and all that. I mean, if we cared about the person, I mean, if we genuinely cared about the person, isn't sometimes a little paternalism called for with people you care about?
Well, first of all, we have made a decision as a society, which I support, that the medical system, because of a long tradition of noxious paternalism where they tried to control other people, the medical system puts respect for autonomy over beneficence, over doing good things for people so that patients' autonomy is protected. And respect for autonomy philosophically requires respecting even bad decisions people make as long as they're capable of making their own decisions. Respect for autonomy, what value would it have if you only respected things people did that you agree with?
But what does that mean, respecting even bad decisions that they make? Do I have a duty at some point to stop arguing with the person or advising the person or haranguing the person? Or
You have a duty... Two duties, a negative and a positive autonomy duty. Your negative duty is not to impose your values on other people. So if somebody doesn't eat well and you think they should eat differently, you have a duty to not interfere excessively. But you also have a positive duty to make sure that they, by their own values, have at least had the support they need to exercise their values. So if they need more support, as Laura said, if their thought processes are confused, et cetera, so that they're not able to act on their own values, then you have a duty to help them. So it's very complicated.
So we're talking about this concept of autonomy, which can maybe mean different things. And I know you borrow from Kant a bit, but you don't fully follow his entire account. Could you say a little bit about the positive account that you borrow from Kant and then where you disagree?
Yes, I mentioned earlier there's this German word that Kant uses for autonomy, which is selbstständig, which means literally like a standing lamp that doesn't need anything else. It stands totally by itself.
Yeah.
And he thinks that that is how autonomy goes, that each person has the absolutely radical individual capacity to reason themselves into a life according to their values. And he talks about a man who's suicidal, who by pure independent reason alone can will himself to live in a suicidal state. So that's, I think Kant's wrong about how radically independent we are, because I think our reason is very much based in our emotional and social matrix, and we need to have people who help us hold open a future. But I think what I like about Kant is that he respects as the most important thing the ability to deliberate or think emotionally and cognitively. And I think that needs respect more than just doing good for people, which can really impose your values on them.
So this ability to deliberate rationally, it sounds like you think that emotions are always going to be a part of that, and that if you have an account of deliberation where it's just pure reason and emotion is not even in the picture, that doesn't describe how we as humans actually reason. Is that right?
Yes, and we can give a great but sad clinical example of that, which is people with early frontotemporal dementias who that lack affect or emotion entirely. They're absolutely at a loss for autonomy. They can't exercise their capacity to care about or value one thing over another. So they're very, very cognitively logical, but they don't care about or feel emotionally moved by a choice of one quality of life over another, they're absolutely at a loss.
This is like the case that Antonio Damasio.
Yeah, the
talks
man with
about.
The pike in his frontal
right.
lobe. Exactly.
So I have a question. I think it's our first ever question from the control booth. It's from our producer and announcer, Joanne Marr. She's producing a show here in KLW called The End of Life Radio Project.
Oh.
And she asks you the following, Jody. Would you advise patients to complete advanced health directives while they are competent in the event that they later become incapacitated? That way, they can spell out their wishes for medical treatment while they're able. Would you advise that?
Yes, and I would definitely advise that. And the most important form of an advanced directive, this is my opinion, is from clinically, I can't prove this, but I think having somebody that you assign durable power of attorney for healthcare that. So having not just a set of specific things, if I'm on a ventilator, I want this, et cetera, but having a person who you can have these in-depth conversations with who can then make flexible decisions for you,
right.
That's much more valuable to the hospital and the medical team being able to really enact your values than one specific wishes.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking about the limits of medical consent with Jody Halpern from the UC Berkeley School of Public Health.
In our final segment, we'll examine what possible changes we should make to our current medical practices. How can we improve a doctor's ability to assess a patient's decision-making capacity?
Assessing the capacity to consent when Philosophy Talk continues. First, he says he's damaged. Then he says it's all under control. How should doctors assess whether their patients have the capacity to consent? I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Laura McGuire, sitting in for John Perry. Our guest is Jody Halpern from the UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And we're thinking about the limits of medical consent.
So before we make you the czar of everything, I want to ask you a follow-up question to some of our earlier discussion. You know, you talk about values, and values are important, and finding out what patient values is important. But values aren't a fixed thing. And so I have this great happy life, and I value my life, I value my family. I suppose if I underwent enough trauma, and had this emotional state, this concretized, hardened emotional state, that could alter my values. So what do you do about that when my values alter as a consequence of these of these happenings?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because I've been spending quite a number of years now doing a project and writing a book, which is still in process, called Remaking the Self in the Wake of Illness. And I realized that I'm writing this book to find out what would have happened if Ms. G lived. Because I've been so affected by that case my entire career. And so I've interviewed many, many people now who had these complex traumatic experiences that involved medical loss and social personal loss, and looked at what happened 2 to 5 years later in their lives. And it's really mind-blowing. People do change in very deep ways. And there's a field called post-traumatic growth where people talk about, and it's sort of like the changes we see with everyone with aging. And aging, of course, does involve medical losses, which is people do shift towards much often deeper conceptions of what matters in life, more Buddhist-type conceptions. Sometimes people become more altruistic, or sometimes very altruistic people become more able to do things for themselves. But I see it as people have unmet developmental needs, and we're sort of like a piano with many keys, and when some can't be played, others get played. This happens with people adapting to disabilities too.
Well, right. That's the next thing I wanted to ask you, because in some ways you could see this as growth, maturation, and all that, but there's also like really unfortunate things.
Right.
I mean, somebody, go back to the thing about the advanced directives. When I'm in my full health, I'd say, if I ever get Alzheimer's, I want you to do X, Y, or Z. I get Alzheimer's, you do X, Y, or Z. I object.
Yes.
I say, don't do that. I don't want to do that anymore. I don't know if that's because I'm the same person. My value. How is the physician supposed to go about weighing?
That's a very tricky case.
Well, in a specific one that's been written about that's very painful for families, when someone has advancing dementia and they're living in a residence, a nursing care facility. There's a case where a woman falls in love in that condition. And there's a film, actually, Away From Her, that really depicts a similar story, where they fall in love with or want to have a relationship with someone else, even though their husband or whatever is still alive, their wife. There's so many different ways people can shift with dementia, and that can be radically painful for people. But I feel that we have to respect, unlike other philosophers, I feel we have to respect the person as he or she is, because of this fact that even if you're cognitively impaired, things you care about shifting are fundamental to who you are. And the purpose of respecting autonomy is ultimately respect for persons, which is not just about the capacity for autonomy, but a deeper fundamental respect for the dignity of a person living, being authentically who they are.
Jody, the title of your book is From Detached Concern to Empathy. So I understand the current model for medical practice is one of being concerned about the patient, but keeping a certain distance for the purposes of being objective, right?
Yes.
And you don't think that's a very good model. So can you say a little bit about that?
Yes, that's what I spend most of my book and my career actually teaching about, which is that we used to think that detachment led to better medical care. Now we know, and there's a lot of empirical research showing that the three pillars of medical care are better met with genuine empathic engagement with your patients. First of all, patients give more information to empathically engaged physicians.
Can you just say what that means?
Empathic engagement?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's my whole life. It means both allowing the patient to move you emotionally. It's okay if you resonate and have some affective response. It's okay if you don't feel a lot. But taking that person very seriously by being curious about what I said this earlier, but the engagement is to try to imagine what it's like to be in the situation the person's in. Not to label them from the outside, but to try to imagine being inside their situation and what matters most. Asking things like, what are you most scared about? What do you most hope for? And trying to imagine that and saying, what am I missing? Never say to anyone, I know how you feel, because everyone's world is different and you don't know. But that's been shown to help people give you more information in a medical history, so you'll make a better diagnosis. Patients trust you more. There's much better adherence to treatment. 50% of meds are not taken as prescribed. If you improve adherence, you improve effective outcomes for high blood pressure, diabetes, right there. And when people are giving bad news, when doctors have to share bad news, serious cancer diagnoses, patients are able to take the information in and activate themselves to make treatment decisions better if the physician delivers the info empathically. Three pillars.
So, I'm wondering, are you worried at all about empathy fatigue?
I am so convinced from lots of great... Who do you think of all doctors are the least burned out? Palliative care physicians dealing with the saddest things.
That's surprising.
Because empathy is accepted and they can process with each other and with their patients their own emotional responses. So detachment does not prevent emotional burnout.
So we got an email from... Pega in Burlington. It's kind of on a different note, but let's see what you have to say about that. She says, great show, thanks. Got to get that part in there. How much should consent be limited when the issue concerns public health, from the extreme of Ebola quarantine to vaccinations and similar concerns like fluoride in the water? How much should we take individual concerns into account when public health is at stake?
That's a great question.
So what do you think, Tony?
Well, we're all talking about autonomy and philosophy talk, so we've talked about Kant, but we didn't bring up Mill. But Mill has the harm principle, which is my autonomy is limited when I am an immediate threat of harming another. So to me, that is a very important area where my medical decisions put other people at immediate risk, then we can have limits on autonomy. Because then
tell me how that plays out. Help Pega see how that plays out in practice.
Well, in a disease that is quickly spreading in a pandemic, I think we can quarantine if need be. I mean, there's great human rights standards so that we always have a moral remainder. If I have to ask people to stay in their home and they lose the ability to support their family during that period or whatever,
right,
society owes them support.
Right.
So we don't forget the human rights moral remainder, but we can restrict each other's rights to the minimum. Minimal restrictions necessary to save other people.
Right. So look, I'm gonna try something else. I'm gonna give you plenary powers. over the entire practice of medicine. You get to make any changes you want. No opposition can be voiced. You say it, and it's so. Like God said, let it be. Jody says, let it be. So what are you going to say, let be? What are the few things you're going to make let be?
I'm going to acknowledge that, first of all, we're all going to die, and second of all, we're all going to have different illnesses, disabilities, and suffering, so we are all vulnerable. That's why the current healthcare plan that came out this week is not my cup of tea, if I can say that on the radio.
Yes, you can. We won't endorse or disendorse it, but yes, you can.
I think that vulnerability is the human condition, and denial of vulnerability is the biggest mistake in our society and in healthcare itself. Doctors deny their own vulnerability. So I think that we need to then practice medicine in a relational way that allows for much more time with physicians and other members of the medical team to be with patients, to know their what matters most, what they're most afraid of, why they're getting the medical care in the first place. Informed consent today focuses almost fetishistically on the medical facts as opposed to on what's your life going to be like with this treatment. So I think we need to allow for the conversations that let us know why patients are getting medical treatment in the first place and how it can serve their life goals.
So we're living in a post-Halperin regime, right? In which medical practice. So take me back to, was it Mrs. G? Is that how patient goes in the literature? So take me back to Mrs. G and walk me through how her treatment would go differently under your regime.
Well, first thing is there would have been, I think the whole medical team who were all able-bodied men who I think unconsciously saw her as a disabled woman who'd lost a husband, as someone whose life was no longer of value. And I think they were so unaware of their own implicit bias and of their own unconscious emotional resonance with her helplessness and hopelessness that they basically gave her morphine as opposed to going back to reengage with her. And so I would have gone back in and not been blocked by their decision-making as a psychiatrist. I think she would have yelled at me, I don't want to talk to you, I don't want to deal with this. And I now know as an experienced psychiatrist that it's important for us to be able to tolerate patients' anger and their feelings that our medical care is useless. Patients who've yelled at me that trying to treat them is useless, if I don't abandon them and I sit there and say, I accept that, they often turn a corner.
Okay, Mrs. G is yelling and screaming at you.
Which is what really happens.
And you're listening.
Yes.
But at some point, has to reach closure. I'm wondering, is the closure point going to be different, or are we just going to feel differently about it after?
No.
She could come to the same decision in the end, right, and decide to refuse the treatment, but under
exactly
different circumstances.
Which she didn't get a chance to express her pain and have me absorb it as a caring psychiatrist. That happened with many other patients since then. This patient who was paralyzed from Guillain-Barré syndrome and refusing care, he yelled at me how much our treatment was useless and a waste, but I stayed in the room. And as I listened and accepted his anger without being defensive, he started to cry. He thought about his situation, and he was able to make his own decisions. A decision that a person can think about, including refusing treatment, if they can think about it over time, we respect it.
So this was the case you witnessed, right?
Yes.
This was early in your practice.
Yes.
So if that had happened, and you were quite disturbed by this case, and
my
it
whole
got
career,
you got you really thinking about this. If that case had gone the way. I mean, would you not still have been would that have eased your disturbance and caused you not to write all this stuff and think about it?
Is it about the end result or the process that gets you
there?
It's
about the process.
But the process, you would have been, I'm just wondering if you, as Jody Halperin, the person, the caring, deeply caring, obviously, psychiatrist, philosopher, all these things that you are, would that really have changed?
Well, I think based on the fact that palliative care doctors have the lowest level of burnout, and I've worked with a lot of teams, I think we can accept when patients are ready to have their lives end for whatever reasons, as long as we feel that there's a process where they were humanely empathized with, where they were able to look in the eyes of others who registered. Primo Levi said that if you talk about your suffering and people are just neutral, you feel your agency disintegrate and you're going to disappear. She never had that sense of someone locking eyes with her, feeling her suffering, feeling like an agent who was respected. Once that's done, tragedy may ensue, but the person can die with feeling respected.
That's really profound. I mean, because as you said, we're all vulnerable, we're all going to die. Those are the two givens. But the quality of that dying And the working out of that vulnerability, that really matters to our lives as human men. That seems to be what you're... Is that a fair...
Yes.
Well, Jody, this has been a profound discussion. I could continue talking to you about this for hours. I think Laura could too. But unfortunately, we have to say goodbye. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Jody Halperin. She's a professor of bioethics at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. She's author of From Detached Concern to Empathy, Humanizing Medical Practice. This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is, get this, cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a partner in that community just by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now, here's a guy who only gives his consent if it takes him less than a minute. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Ian Scholes, I don't have any facts or data at my fingertips, which should not present an obstacle to my thinking, seldom does, but I do know that a recent Super Bowl contained an ad for medication designed to treat opioid-caused constipation. When I was a kid, we worried more about junkies robbing gas stations to support their habit. We did not give much thought to their digestive problems. I always thought addicts spent all their time worrying about the next fix. But today's opioids are prescribed by doctors, not pushers. Today's addicts have gas pains just like my great-aunt from Indiana. Watch the Super Bowl and find a solution to their bowel issues right there after the halftime show. But not the solution, alas, to their addiction. I don't know the name of this particular opioid constipation medication, but a Google search revealed dozens, including Amitza, Lubistrone, Movantik, Relistor, Semprorec, among others. Not to be judgy, but shouldn't we be as worried about the rampant prescribing of addictive painkillers as we are about the discomfort caused by its side effects? Lest we forget, another opioid side effect is sudden death. Anyway, when comedian Bill Maher made a joke about the Super Bowl ad, there was immediate backlash, particularly from the president of the Pain Foundation, a support group for pain-afflicted people, himself a sufferer. Again, not to be judgy, but maybe we need more doctors and fewer grief counselors. If we are proactive about death, you see, the need for grief could be forestalled. Maybe we need to read the instructions before we drink the Kool-Aid. The thing is, though, everybody today, aside from Trump voters, I guess, are highly evolved progressive people who eat organic chicken, chew kale, watch our gluten intake, have a Fitbit that monitors our Fitbit, only drive with Uber drivers who are close personal friends, and we either know everything or know how to Google someone who does. I have seen with my own eyes a woman getting a medical opinion from the guy who stocked the herbal medicine aisle at Whole Foods. Throw on the internet, and it's a wonder we even need doctors anymore. Back in the 90s, the FDA stupidly permitted the advertising of prescription drugs on TV. It did mandate that major risks be stated in the ads, which resulted in a narrator talking really fast about rectal bleeding and projectile vomiting, while some young-looking yet silver-haired guy walked around looking fit. These ads all end with a variation of, ask your doctor if prosaxophene is right for you. So the advertiser is just saying. The ball is totally in your court, television viewer with toenail fungus. Ask your doctor if Mortaxacol will alleviate the pain that may be caused by any potential infection. And if your doctor hasn't even heard of Gorbaxiathon, get a new doctor. Vaccines and evolution and climate change hysteria are the problem here, not you. You're an informed citizen with undiagnosed irritable bowel syndrome. And if those pills cost $20 a pop, well, it's the insurance paying for it, not you. Costs are edging up to $200 billion a year. A headache for somebody, not for me. No more headaches, see? I asked my doctor if pentobarbital was right for me. Aside from the blisters, works great. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Audrey Dilling, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Side effects of Ultravax and Max may include... Actually, it's quicker to say the side effects it doesn't include.